Hello everyone, how are you doing? Welcome to another episode of Blood Runs Cold, the true crime podcast looking at cases involving murder, missing persons, miscarriages of justice and more, with the emphasis on the victims of these crimes. I'm Peter, creator and host of this podcast, and in this episode I'm going to go back to the 1980s to cover what was a landmark case in police history, that being the case of Little Miss Nobody, Karen Price. Before we get going, I'd just like to say thank you to those who are listening and who have listened to the previous episodes, or even if you haven't, if you're just listening now, thank you very much. To those who have subscribed over on YouTube or given us a follow on social media, honestly, thank you. It means a lot, and I will be eternally grateful to each and every one of you. If you have any feedback for me about this podcast, I would love to hear it. You can head over to YouTube and leave a comment. You can message on Instagram or Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it. It may be possible to leave feedback on the podcast platform you're listening on, if it allows it. And I'm hoping to hear what you think I'm doing well, the positives, what you think I could improve on, any negatives. And also, any cases that you're interested in that you think would make a good episode, let me know. As always, I'd like to give a warning out before we start that this case may include details some of you may find distressing, upsetting, or triggering in some way. Obviously, it's going to include murder and sexual assault and stuff. Some of you may find that upsetting. So check the show notes or the episode description before any episode you listen to and proceed with caution if you are likely to find any of the topics triggering. I know that some of you may be out there thinking, well, it's a true crime podcast. It's not going to be about glittery rainbows and pretty pink unicorns, is it? But I feel the need to give out a little warning just in case, as it isn't my aim to upset anyone. So now we've got that out of the way. Without further ado, let's get on with the case. On the 7th of December 1989, a team of builders working on a renovation job at Fitzhammond Embankments in the Riverside area of Cardiff in Wales were digging up the garden near to the basement flat of numbers 27 to 29 in order to lay some pipes. However, while they were digging, they made a shocking discovery. The builders found a roll of carpet, which wasn't in itself that shocking, but the carpet had been secured with an electrical flex cord. The builders were curious, so they examined the roll of carpet, and inside they discovered what they believed to be a human skeleton. Paul Bodenham, one of the builders who made the discovery, said, "We unwrapped the carpet and saw part of a body. As soon as we saw the bones, we left it alone and called the police." Police arrived on the scene soon afterwards and officers unrolled the carpet fully. Inside, they found a skeleton, binding that was appearing to tie the arms of the person behind their back, and a head that was inside a plastic bag. Retired Detective Sergeant Jeff Norman was one of the first officers at the scene, and he later said, "I was the first on the scene with a detective inspector. By that point, the carpet had been unfurled a little bit. Immediately, you could see there were bones and it was highly suspicious. Little did we know at that point what we were dealing with." A pathologist was then called in and they confirmed that these were indeed human skeletal remains. A police investigation would begin, with more than 80 officers drafted in within days to investigate, although at this time, Detective Chief Superintendent John Williams wasn't referring to it as a murder case. He was interviewed shortly after the body was found and he said, "I'm not calling it murder at the moment until we find a cause of death, but because the body was wrapped in a carpet and because someone has obviously taken time to bury it so that it should never be found, then of course, at this time, we have to treat it very seriously indeed." The main priority at that time was to identify the remains. As it wasn't possible for an identification using normal methods, the police had to figure out how long the body had been there and then look back over missing persons cases and stuff like that. The pathology report carried out by a top Home Office pathologist identified the bones as belonging to a female aged approximately between 15 and 20. There was no flesh remaining on the bones, which indicated that it wasn't a recent burial, but there was some hair and clothing. This clothing included part of a pair of jeans, a jumper, and a bra which contained a label reading Mrs. Knickers. A further dental report narrowed the age of the remains down even further to between 15 and 16, and also confirmed a violent death due to blood that had been forced into a tooth cavity. So, if the fact that the body had been bound, rolled in carpet and buried in the back garden had been a sign that a murder had taken place, the confirmation of a violent death definitely did. As well as a pathologist report, entomologists were called in to carry out a study of insect eggs around the site where the remains were found. With the reports put together, police ascertained that the body had been there for around about 8 years. Now the police had some details to go on in order to get their investigation underway. Firstly, they would check old missing persons reports to see if any teenage girl had been reported missing during the estimated time they were given for when their victim had been killed. And the next step was to examine the clothes found with the girl's remains. By examining the jeans, they concluded they weren't of great quality and must have been cheap, which led them to believe their victim came from a poor background. The bra with the distinctive label was found to have been manufactured sometime between 1979 and 1983. So with a small amount of physical evidence they had, as well as both the pathologist and entomologist reports, police gave a time of death of sometime between 1981 and 1984, with the earlier date looking more likely. Lines of inquiry police also followed were to find previous tenants of the basement flat at Fitzhamon Embankment and fully examine the carpet that the remains had been rolled up in. Previous tenants were located eventually, and officers found out the carpet was purchased by a woman who lived in the flat between 1980 and 1981. After more investigation, it was found the carpet had been fitted on the 6th of September, 1980. This information even led police to the person who had fitted the carpet, and that person revealed that part of the carpet found rolled around the girl's body was an offcut of the one that they had fitted in the flat. So, police were getting nearer to discovering the actual time frame the body had been buried in the garden, but they were no nearer to identifying who the body actually was. Looking into missing persons reports that had led nowhere, and as previously mentioned, they couldn't use traditional methods of identification. As they couldn't give a name, police and the media referred to the girl as Little Miss Nobody. Honestly, it's beyond me, really, how a teenage girl can go missing, not be found for almost a decade, and not a single person reported her missing or has been looking for her. I don't get it. It's something that completely baffles me. Was there not one person who cared enough about her to have tried to find her in, like, nearly a decade? That's a long time, you know? Anyway, the fact that they couldn't identify her using traditional means led investigating officers to follow a rather unusual path. They contacted facial reconstruction expert Richard Neave, and they asked him if he could use the remains to create a model of what she actually looked like when she was alive. This method had never been used in criminal investigation before, and there were many sceptics. Scientific professionals and other experts believed the process of facial reconstruction was mainly guesswork, and that it had no merit. Neave was not to be put off by the doubters, though, and he went ahead with the police's request. Using a girl's skull and a unique technique of using wooden pegs to plot different thicknesses and contours of the face, Richard Neave created a full clay model of the girl's reconstructed head in just 5 days. As it happened, at the time, the Daily Mail had become interested in Neave's work before the police had contacted him about creating a model of their unidentified victim's head. So, he contacted the newspaper to let them know what he was working on, and they were on hand to photograph the head once the model was complete. These photographs were published and circulated nationwide in the hope that someone would recognise the victim. And within a couple of days, two different people had contacted police and given them the same name. That name was Karen Price. Now, police just had to confirm what they had been told. To do this, they went down two avenues. Firstly, Karen's dental records were obtained after they finally had a name and were matched to the remains. Then, they tracked down Karen's biological parents, who provided officers with photographs which showed an almost identical girl to the model that Richard Neave created. Unfortunately, though, just the likeness and dental records weren't enough to 100% prove that the remains were Karen, so forensic scientists extracted DNA from the remains, and they then matched this to Karen's parents. The test proved that without a shadow of a doubt, the remains found in the garden of the basement flat at Fitzhamon Embankment in December 1989, and that the police had called Little Miss Nobody, were in fact Karen Price. Police had used a combination of pathology, entomology, facial reconstruction, old-fashioned investigation work and groundbreaking science in order to identify the remains as Karen. Former Detective Sergeant Norman, who I mentioned before, believed the case was groundbreaking and had a massive impact on not only his career, but in later cases all over the world. Speaking in a documentary on the BBC entitled The Dark Land in 2023, he said, quote, "When I think back to that evening, I think of the impact it has had, not only on my career, but the advances in the investigation that went on to be used in investigations nationally and internationally. The techniques that were used, the different ologists who were involved, some of whom I'd never heard of, but were all used to assist us in our investigation," end quote. But the groundbreaking effort to identify Karen's body was only half the job for the police. They now had to work out who Karen was when she was alive, and also, if they could, who had killed her. The first thing they had to do was compile a kind of biography of Karen, looking into her history. They hoped that this would answer the question as to why nobody had really cared about her going missing, and also to identify the person responsible for her death. Sadly, that look into her history painted a rather bleak picture. Karen had apparently been neglected from a young age and had basically been pushed from pillar to post. Not a lot of details are available for me to give the exact reasoning behind it, but Karen would eventually be taken into care when she was 10 years old. In early 1981, when she was 15, Karen was then moved and became a resident at an assessment centre in Pontypridd. She also attended Greenhill Special School in Rubina in Cardiff. Police officers questioned those who may have known her and noted the last known sighting of Karen was in early July 1981, when she had run away from the assessment centre. They also found out that her disappearance had been reported at the time, although no missing persons report was filed and nobody bothered to follow it up. A social worker who remembered Karen described her as being quite immature for her age, shy and desperate to be liked and wanted to make friends. Unfortunately, she apparently made friends with what was described as the more delinquent type. She was said to have enjoyed listening to music and liking fashion. Sadly, the social worker also described how she was searching for love, but didn't quite know how to go about that. Karen's case was eventually featured on Crime Watch UK on the BBC in February 1990, with an actress playing the role of the 15-year-old. Presenter Nick Ross also narrated the case and gave details of places that Karen usually hung out, like a cafe where she went for coffee, or the bus station opposite Cardiff Central Railway Station. Clothes similar to the grey sweatshirt and plum-coloured jeans that Karen was wearing at the time of her death were shown, and an appeal made for anyone who may have known her or who had any information that may help the police in their investigation. One person watching the programme did have some information, and he was a man named Idris Ali, who was now a married father of one and lived in Cardiff. He had mentioned to his friend who he was watching Crime Watch with that he used to know Karen. The friend then called into the show three times, and by the next day, Ali was being questioned as a witness. Over the course of the next few days, detectives quizzed Ali and he told them several varying accounts of his relationship with Karen and what had happened to her. Initially, he told them he had met Karen at school and that they had become friends, but under further questioning, he later admitted to being her pimp. Apparently, he made his money by pimping out two girls, Karen and her friend who she had known in the children's home and who had later been a resident at the same assessment centre. Ali also admitted it was his idea that Karen should start selling her body for sex. Within days, Ali had gone from a witness to a suspect in Karen's murder. Further investigations then found a link to a 21-year-old local nightclub bouncer by the name of Alan Charlton, who was described as a bit of a ladies' man with a fearsome reputation, but who people looked up to. In what was an important piece of information, police officers also discovered Charlton had lived in the basement flat where Karen's body was found at the time of her disappearance. This put him firmly in the police's crosshairs. It was believed that Ali, who was around the age of 16 in 1981, looked up to Charlton and kind of aspired to be like him. It was kind of this hero worship, so to speak, that led Ali to take Karen and her friend, who was just 13 years old at the time, to Charlton's flat for a party. Charlton had said he wanted a couple of young girls and Ali complied with his wishes. Nobody other than the two men and the two girls knew about the party or where the party was taking place. Now, the following information comes from what was given in witness statements by Ali and the girl known as Witness D in court papers. So I can't say for absolute certainty if this information is 100% true, but it's the accounts given by the only two witnesses to Karen's death. Both Ali and D gave varying accounts to police, but there was a lot of information they gave that matched up. In these accounts, it tells of a pretty brutal and rage-filled end to Karen's short life. Apparently, when they were at the flat, Charlton demanded that the two underage girls strip naked and perform sex acts on each other while he took photographs. Witness D said in her statement that she refused, and this led to Charlton getting angry and giving her a slap. Karen then also refused to partake in Charlton's demands, and this led to him becoming infuriated. The bouncer, who was obviously used to getting his own way, attacked Karen. He grabbed her by the throat and punched her with such force that she was knocked unconscious and she fell to the ground. Witness D then says she closed her eyes as Charlton continued to attack Karen in a rage. I read one thing that said Charlton pushed Ali away when the younger male stepped in to try and calm the situation, but Witness D's account in court apparently said the younger man had held Karen's arms while Charlton attacked her. Witness D then said that when she opened her eyes again, there was blood coming out of Karen's mouth and she was unresponsive. Then, in a sickening act, Charlton bound Karen's arms behind her back, placed a plastic bag over her head, removed her underwear and raped her either after she had died or as she was dying. He then apparently ordered Ali to have sex with her as well, although I'm not sure if this happened or not. He then also forced the younger man to help him dispose of Karen's body. Charlton then warned Witness D that if she ever said anything to anyone, she would meet the same brutal end as her friend Karen had. D told the court later that she never saw either man again after that night. According to Ali, Karen's body then remained in Charlton's flat for 4 days before they buried her in the garden. Both men were arrested and formally charged with the murder of Karen Price on the 23rd of February 1990. It turned out Charlton had actually been questioned by police already because he was a former tenant of the flat, but the officers had no evidence at the time to do anything other than ask a few questions. Ali insisted he had nothing to do with the attack on Karen, that he was just a scared bystander as Charlton had killed her, but he was charged with murder nonetheless. Ali even said that Karen's murder had played on his mind for almost a decade, but he couldn't say anything earlier because he didn't know how he would explain it to his family, and he was also ashamed. Both men deny killing Karen, but they would both stand trial for murder in 1991, with Witness D being the key prosecution witness. During the trial, D gave her version of events to the court, telling them exactly what had happened on that tragic night in Charlton's basement flat. The court also heard and was shown other evidence, as well as Ali's account of events as well. Despite both men pleading not guilty, it took the jury just 5 hours of deliberation before reaching a unanimous decision. Their verdict was that both Alan Charlton and Idris Ali were guilty of the murder of 15-year-old Karen Price. When passing sentence, Mr. Justice Rose said, quote, "You have both been convicted of the appalling murder of a 15-year-old girl, and you have been convicted on overwhelming evidence. Because of the passage of years and numerous lies that both of you told, it will probably never be known precisely the sequence of events that led to this girl's murder, but clearly, you both took part." End quote. Charlton, described as a devious and intelligent individual who ruled by fear, was sentenced to life in prison for Karen's murder. Ali was also initially given the life sentence for murder, I believe, but his murder conviction was later overturned. In 1994, he was granted a retrial, and this time he pled guilty to manslaughter. This led to him being released from prison as he was sentenced to time already served. I believe he did end up back inside for subsequent crimes, though, although I don't have details of what those crimes were. There were suggestions that Charlton's conviction could be overturned as well after Ali's was, and this led to further appeals in 2014, with the Criminal Cases Review Commission looking into it. Then, in 2015, Ali's conviction was also under the microscope. The latter had said he only admitted to playing a part in Karen's death in order to be released from prison. So, basically saying that he lied when he pled guilty to manslaughter at his retrial, just so that he could be released from his murder charge. Apparently, there were also concerns over breaches in the police's code of conduct during their investigations. Charlton's barrister, Louise Blackwell QC, had told the appeal court that there were similarities between the investigation into Karen's death and the Lynette White case. For those who don't know, Lynette White was murdered in Cardiff in February 1988, and three men were found guilty of murder and all sentenced to life imprisonment. However, 2 years later, the men who had become known as the Cardiff Three all had their convictions quashed and were released from prison after it emerged witnesses had fabricated evidence, and her real killer was eventually caught using familial DNA testing in 2003. Several police officers, some still serving at the time and others retired, were prosecuted for corruption in 2011 in relation to the Lynette White case. Two witnesses for the prosecution in the initial trial were also charged with perjury. However, the case collapsed and no convictions were won against any of them. So, back to Charlton's appeal. And Blackwell said there was evidence to suggest that during the investigation into Karen's death, police officers had developed a theory about what had happened. And then they interviewed witnesses based upon that theory. She also put doubts on the credibility of Witness D's evidence. The Criminal Cases Review Commission highlighted several concerns regarding possible breaches of police regulations during the investigation into Karen's murder, and they even noted possible oppressive handling of witnesses. After news of this appeal was revealed, South Wales Police Chief Constable Peter Vaughan said that the judicial process would now take its course and that he couldn't comment any further at that stage. And the judicial process did take its course. The Court of Appeals dismissed both Charlton's and Ali's appeals in 2016 and upheld both of their convictions. A 46-page judgment of the appeals can be read online that details all of the witness evidence given during the initial investigation and details of any appeals that were made before and the final judgment and reasoning behind upholding both men's convictions. So, the saga of appeals was over and the black cloud that hung over the police who had investigated Karen's murder had now dissipated. But even though there has been some sort of justice gained for Karen, I can't help feeling aggrieved for her and sad that she was so alone in the world at such a young age that she ended up in a situation that ultimately cost her her life. The most tragic part of all this, in my opinion, is that a 15-year-old girl can end up disappearing from the care system and not a single person cared enough to try and find her, to look into where she had gone or what she was doing in those years after her disappearance. Surely the care system has a duty of care, it's in the name. They should have been hammering down the door at the police station the moment she went missing. Officers should have been looking for her to return her back to the assessment centre. But she was left on her own in the big wide world and ended up on the game and then brutally murdered. This was a vulnerable, neglected and probably mentally fucked up child who was searching for someone to love her, for a love she hadn't known from her biological family or from anyone else really. In her quest for that love, in her quest to feel wanted and to make friends, she ended up being sold for sex by someone she had met at school, someone she had trusted and who she believed to be her friend, but who was actually just exploiting her and making her sell herself for him to make some money. Then, ultimately, that so-called friend led her to an older man who beat her and strangled her and then used her body for his own gratification before disposing of her in his back garden. It's a tragic, tragic story. Karen Price wasn't loved enough or cared about enough when her remains were found more than 8 years after her disappearance that she had become known as Little Miss Nobody, because there didn't seem to be a single person who knew who she was or who had missed her. But hopefully, all these years later, her story will continue to be told and Karen Price will never, ever be forgotten. Right, that is the end of another case covered. I hope you enjoyed listening to it, and if you didn't know Karen's story or didn't know too many details about it, I hope you've learned something and been touched by her story. Like I said, it's very tragic. It's a tragic story, but unfortunately one that is far too commonplace. You read about young girls going missing and ended up on the game and stuff all the time, and that get themselves into situations that ultimately cost them their lives. It's extremely sad, but what can you do? It's happened now. But that is the case of Little Miss Nobody, Karen Price. Like I said, thank you all so much for listening. I appreciate your support. And remember, you can give us a follow on social media. And as I said at the start of this episode, I would love to hear your feedback. I'll be back again very soon with another episode. And I hope you will all join me again next time. Until then, take care, don't have nightmares, and bye-bye for now.